Hello, this is Nikki Moran, and I'm talking today with an artist called Jeremy Sutton, who's based in San Francisco. Jeremy is not only an artist, he's also an author, an educator, and a speaker, and specializes in combining multimedia with traditional art tools. Recent commissions include a large heart that sits in the middle of Union Square in the heart of San Francisco, which depicts the Golden Gate Bridge on one side and scenes of film noir on the other. And he travels all over the world doing workshops and talks, and he's just about to do one in London. Jeremy, welcome.
Well, thank you very much. Appreciate that nice introduction, Nikki.
It sounds great. Do you want to tell us a little bit, first of all, what you're doing in London and
the
workshop you're going to be doing?
Yeah, well, on July 25th, that's a Monday evening, at the Union Club in Soho on Greek Street, I'm going to do a live digital painting demonstration, which is open to everybody. Just email me at jeremy@jeremysutton.com if you're going to come along so that I can let them know about numbers. But I'm going to do a little bit of demonstration of how I use particular art tools on the computer, those being Corel Painter 12 software and something called a Wacom tablet. It's my interface that I use for working with the computer is a pen-based interface. That's what the Wacom tablet offers you. And so at the demo, I'll be using those tools on a Macintosh and doing some live portraiture and also showing a little bit of other things, working from photos. I know a lot of people really like to, you know, start with a digital photo and create something that's got a painterly feel to it. So I'll show a little bit of insight about that. I'm also running a workshop, a three-day workshop, that for the 25th, 26th, 27th, if anybody's interested. And they can just go to my website, jeremysutton.com, and then find out from there about all the things that I'm doing.
Exciting. So you're doing loads of different things.
Always keeping busy, Nikki. Always keeping busy.
And just to give you some context, people listening here, how we met, you're not only an artist, but you're actually a very good Lindy Hop dancer as well, because about a week ago, we were dancing on a boat in the middle of Amsterdam, bopping to swing jazz music and swapping life stories, and which is where you kindly agreed to be interviewed by me.
Absolutely. And Lindy Hop is indeed a connection, and it's something that I've loved for many, many years. And what's interesting is I see so many parallels between the painting process and the dancing process. And, the way that my paintings unfold, it always reminds me of a dance, you know, move into the music, hitting the brakes, having quiet times and then louder times and small movements and big movements and sort of really basically creating a dance on the canvas.
I love that. Yeah, because on your website you describe your processes, your paintings evolve like improvisational dance.
Yeah, they do. And, you know, it's like flowing with the moment, just as we do in our Lindy Hop. You know, when there's something that comes up in the music that you can play with, you know, let's grab it and do something with it. And the same thing happens in every artwork is something comes up that maybe I didn't expect or that's spontaneous, and then I just go for it and do something with it. I should just share one interesting little aside to do with painting process and the use of digital technology, which is something I combine in most of my artwork. Not all. I do traditional work as well without digital, but one of the things that people I tend to get asked is like, oh, you use the computer. Is that because it allows you to edit things or undo things, you know, make it easy like that? And the irony is that the answer for me is no, not at all. Although, of course, the computer offers you incredible amount of editing and undoing, the way that I paint digitally involves just as much commitment to the process and to the brushstrokes as when I'm working with traditional media. So actually, I don't undo when I'm painting, and I'm always moving forward with the artwork just as I am if I was working with traditional media.
Yeah, because most of the time, computers are about polishing up or making it perfect, but you very much use it like you do live art.
Absolutely, and in fact, it's the imperfection that often makes the life and personality of the painting So I cherish the things that don't quite work. I love the stuff that you might think of as a mistake, but really it's not a mistake. It's just like going to add history and richness and texture to your final artwork. So I welcome all of that, and that's something that I will, you know, on my demo on the 25th of July, I will be showing that in action. So if you catch me doing an undo then, you know, you better let me know and call me a hypocrite. I'll have to watch out
now. Interesting. That's a great approach then, Jeremy, because I think that's right. You know, being an artist is about going with the flow of it and allowing things and, you know, not seeing things as mistakes, but seeing it as part of it and, you know, making it something that's original and living and breathing.
Absolutely. It's also commitment to process. And I think that, you know, when it comes to talking about how do you make your living as an artist, how do you follow a path in which you're, you know, really manifesting your passion for creativity and art in your life and in your career, that commitment to process is exactly really the key and core element of everything. Because as with any creative process, there's always going to be bumps in the road. I mean, they're part of the road. The bumps are there no matter what. And there's always ugly times. And, you know, with every painting I do, there's a point at which it's like, ugh, you know, I don't like it. It's the ugly stage, so to speak. It's like, oh, my gosh, this is not working. And so it's what you do with that point in the road that really determines whether you whether you stick with something and develop it successfully or whether you give up and say, oh, forget it, you know, and walk away from it. And I think that that is also key to one of the things that you talk about on your website, which is this whole essence of, like, how do you take your innate talents and your passions and then transform that into earning a living? And one of the things is you're going to have bumps in the road. And if you just give up and get frustrated at those bumps, you'll say, oh, forget it, I'll walk away. But if you think of it like a painting where you're going to keep moving forward, then you'll be successful whatever you do, I believe.
That's such a great way of looking at it, because I think one of the innate problems for some artists or creatives is that they tend to be unbelievably self-critical and perfection seekers. So that it's painful for them to see something that isn't really, really good or really, really excellent. So I think, you know, what you're saying is it's all part of the process, and it's about using those stages, you know, because that's where you develop your craft and that's where you add richness to your palette.
Yeah, absolutely. And I see this, you know, I love teaching, and in my workshops and classes, you know, one of the roles that I play as a teacher is to really encourage people to have the sort of strength of commitment to process, even when things get very frustrating. In any artistic development, you have to do a lot of beginnings, a lot of studies, a lot of trial and error. There's a lot of things that are not going to work or necessarily look good. But that's all part of the learning process and development process. And in fact, I really encourage people to cherish those things rather than see them as reasons to give up. When you're learning and developing your eye, you're going to create a lot of things which are studies, and they're not finished masterpieces. They're not necessarily developed and, you know, works. Their studies are on their way, and I actually see a lot of beauty in those early stages. I have to just share something with you. A few weeks ago, I went to see this exhibition in San Francisco. It's called The Steins Collect, Matisse, Picasso, and beyond. And it was basically a collection of artwork collected in the early 20th century, the early 1900s, by the Stein family. Of course, Gertrude Stein was the most famous of them. But it included a lot of early Matisse's and early Picasso's. And one of the things I loved was that the Matisse's in particular they were, a lot of them were studies. They were rough, they were unfinished works, yet they had so much life to them. And I just loved them, and I actually loved them even more than some of his finished works. So there's so much to say for those early stages.
It's part of your personality, isn't it, as an artist, those different stages, because it's, you know, it's like you're maturing, but those early stages say so much about, you know, your, you know, what you're learning and how you're being, and, you know, it's so good to see that and the depth that arise.
Absolutely, and there's also just the freshness. At another exhibition at the Young Museum in San Francisco last year, post-impressionist show from the Museum d'Orsay, they had some early sketches of, I'm trying to think, it was one of the Pontilist painters, Seurat style of things, and they had these early sketches which were so lovely. So it was before he'd made the Pontilist versions, which were very precise and very thought out and very developed. These were like really early rough sketches, and again, I just loved them. So I always cherish those the sketchy early stuff.
When you were in your early stages, because you haven't always been an artist, of course. You've always painted, but you actually studied originally physics, didn't you?
That's right. I mean, I've you know, drawn since I was 3 or 4 years old, and I've basically grown up always making art. And I went and studied physics at Oxford and got a degree in physics. But while I was there, I really got even more into art. I mean, I went to the Ruskin School and did drawing and sculpture and printmaking. Loved it. But indeed, career-wise, my first sort of career, so to speak, was 12 years working for Oxford Instruments, selling superconducting magnets and cryogenic research systems around the world. That took me to live in the Netherlands, which is how you might have noticed I spoke a little bit of what I call rusty Dutch, pretty basic Dutch. And that's also what took me to live in Silicon Valley in the San Francisco Bay Area back in the late 1980s. And that's where I first got exposed to digital painting.
So what was your journey into moving into being an artist? Is it something that you wanted to do at an early age but didn't have the courage earlier on? What was that journey like?
You know, I always, from an early age, assumed I would, you know, eventually become an artist of some kind. And so that was there as an early dream. And then I, you know, got into the physics thing and enjoyed that, and assumed I would be doing research or something in physics. But the art passion kept popping its head up, and no matter what I did, I would sketch incessantly. I would be doing art things all the time in my spare time. So it was always popping its head up as something that I just loved to do and couldn't not do. And throughout my, you know, career in physics, sales and marketing, I was still doing my art, traveling to India as part of it, and then I'd be sketching everywhere I went. Even doing presentations to one of the local Rotary clubs in Bangalore about the fun of drawing and things like that. So it just kept being part of my life and was always important to me. And I think that it's such an interesting question. Is that, well, did I, you know, how did it come to be that I ended up knowing that that's where I wanted to go with my career?
I'm curious if it was I can't do this anymore, or was it sort of a slow progression?
It was definitely an aspect of feeling that with my physics job, whilst I was good at it and I enjoyed all the opportunities it offered, and it was a great job, it wasn't necessarily where my heart was, and it also wasn't necessarily what I felt I wanted to contribute to the world in, you know, being here. If this is what my life is about, is this really what I want to be doing, and is this what is this what I'm meant to be here for? And the steps that really led to the transition, which was a bit of a dramatic transition, I have to admit, was really four very specific steps. And the first step was in 1991 when I was doing some sketching at a party in Woodside, which is near Palo Alto in the San Francisco Bay Area. And someone saw me sketching and they said, "Oh, wow, that's good. Would you like to meet a friend of mine who makes painting software?" And I said, "Of course." And I had no idea what they were talking about. Mm-hmm. But I got introduced to Claire Barry, who was responsible for Pixel Paint Pro at a company called Supermac, sat me down, put a Wacom tablet on my lap, and there I drew my first digital portrait on a Macintosh with this software, and I just fell in love with the whole thing. I thought, wow, this is something I need to explore. And she loved what she saw and said, "What are you doing in 2 weeks? We've got a trade show. Would you like to come and paint on our booth?" It was actually the Wacom booth. I said, "Sure, I'll just take time off work and come along." And that's what I did. So from the get-go, I was working with the vendors and started to explore this new medium, which was digital paint. I'd never really seen anything like it or experienced anything like it before. That was 1991. And then a couple of years later, I got my green card. I mean, I was here as a Brit working in California. But I couldn't really, I wasn't really free to do anything else other than sell superconducting magnets. So I got my green card, and I have to say, at that point, I thought, well, I could just give everything up now and become an artist, but then I thought, but I got a good job, got a company car. It's like, maybe I should just wait. And the truth of the matter is, if the next step hadn't happened, I wonder if I would still be in that career of some kind. Because the next step was 3 months later, I got laid off. And I thought, ah, okay, this was a bit of a shocker. Didn't expect it. And I actually looked for a job in similar fields for a couple of weeks, sent out a few resumes. And then I thought, and I guess this is a transition point, and this is the fourth stage here, where I just thought, you know, maybe this is the opportunity for me to do what I'm really meant to do with my life and just go for it as an artist.
That's incredible.
Yeah. So, and I'd written to the Virgin Atlantic Company because I'd read that they were going to start flying into San Francisco. And I'd suggested that I did a digital portrait of Richard Branson when he came to town. And it was all around this time, and they replied and said, "Well, we think that's a great idea for you to draw Richard Branson on the plane on a computer."
Wow.
So I said, yeah, of course. That's not actually what I had in mind, but I didn't tell them that. I quickly borrowed a PowerBook from Apple, an early edition of it, and went on this incredible experience drawing Richard Branson on his inaugural flight into San Francisco.
What a great story.
So that was the kickoff to my career as a artist.
That's incredible.
Yeah, it was quite an experience, I tell you.
So after the kind of shock of being laid off, you probably went through this transition of complete and utter panic, and then it was like, okay, you know, it just loomed on you. Here is my opportunity. And I'm intrigued that you the first thing you did was to do something really quite commercial. Like, you know, doing a picture of, you know, probably the most famous man in the world.
Sure. Well, for me, I've always loved drawing portraits, and I like to meet interesting people.
Yeah.
He was definitely on my list of interesting people I wanted to meet in person. So I made that all happen. And,
were you being strategic at this time when you were kind of launching yourself?
I would say I was being inadvertently strategic, with following my intuition about what would work for me, and also just being true to myself as much as I could be about the things I really wanted to create in my life. So I really wanted to meet Richard Branson and paint him, and I thought, well, why not ask? And I did, and that's what happened.
That's great.
So things like that, you know, I think that, you know, there's a great power in being true to what you really want and believe in, and then going for it and asking for it.
Yeah.
And, you know, you won't get a yes every day, and you won't get results every day, but if you don't ask, you'll never get the results.
Yeah. Have to be brave. How important do you think it is, Jeremy, to be kind of a little bit commercial if you're an artist and you want to be successful, make a a living from your art. How important do you think it is to have that kind of mindset of what will sell or what's going to put me on the map?
Well, I think there's a whole bunch of different questions wrapped up in that one question, because in doing Richard Branson, I wasn't trying to be commercial. I actually genuinely wanted to meet him, and I thought it would be fascinating to paint him on the computer. And so it, obviously there's publicity and there's kudos that comes with that, but I wasn't actually necessarily thinking commercial so much. But having said that, I think that it's a balance. I think it's really important to do what's true to you, because that's going to be your most powerful art. You know, if we're talking about fine art and creating, you know, artwork, I think you have to be true to yourself and not just try to fabricate something only for the point of view of, well, I think this will sell, so I'm going to do this.
So it's got to start from you within. What do you love? What are you about?
Yeah, and develop. Also, that's part of developing yourself as an artist, which is something I, you know, I think about all the time. And even though I've been doing this for years and years, I still think it's really important for me to not forget to take time to do things for myself as an artist and that stretch myself as an artist. Now, having said all that, I think that doing things for clients and satisfying clients' needs can also be a great discipline as an artist, and actually important discipline for developing yourself as an artist, as well as being able to be successful commercially. So let me give you an example. I had done a portrait of a gentleman's two daughters a few years ago. He's a client of mine who's a property developer on the East Bay of the San Francisco Bay Area in Oakland. And then this year, he commissioned me to do a large painting, 6 foot by 8 foot, for a lobby of one of his buildings, which is a historic building in Oakland. And he wanted something a bit more abstract. So this is a little different for me. It's going to be a challenge. It's going to be very different to anything I've done before. But I am really looking forward to taking this on and developing the ideas that come out of it, because this is how I'm going to stretch myself, you know, as an artist. And I, you know, I'm going to do something that he loves, and I'll make sure of that. So I will, you know, in that sense, if you want to call it commercial, I'm going to make sure that my client is happy. But at the same time, I'm going to really stretch myself artistically on every level with my use of materials, my media, my subject matter, and the scale of the work. So on every one of those counts, it's going to push me. So I love to take on a project like that that
pushes
me. Were you
scared that he wasn't going to like the end result? If it was some, you know, it, particularly as it's something that is new to you, that's not your normal style, was there a fear factor in there that it
Well,
wasn't?
No, it's still, well, what'll happen is, I'm still working on it. I've come up with a preliminary design, which, you know, he likes, and now we go on to the next stage. So the thing is, one of the key things about the way that I paint, which, again, is relevant to this whole issue of career and art, is that I look at the surface of my canvas as a completely malleable surface. So I'm never completely attached to it as being immutable and static. So I'm prepared to let go of anything and everything at any moment. And this is a sort of, it's scary, but it's also powerful. So that way, you know, you can't go wrong. No matter what happens, as long as there's communication between me and my client, he, you know, it will end up being a piece that's going to be, you know, really dynamic, and he will love it, because I will work at it until that point.
So you'll bring the client into the process and allow
to a certain extent, Now, and also he knows my work, he's seen my work, and so he's commissioning me to do this because he has confidence in the way I approach my art and my use of color and all those things. So he actually, you know, it's not out of the blue that he's commissioned me to do this. One thing I would say that's connected with this, and I think relevant to what you're doing with artists and creative people, is that in terms of commercialism and actually, you know, working with clients and producing art for a job, a paid job, I think that one of the key things is professionalism, and I can't emphasize it enough.
Mm-hmm.
So my background in sales and marketing for 12 years with Oxford Instruments meant that I had ingrained in me what it means to be a professional.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
that and there's a lot of things that are really key to professionalism that I think that if you don't, if you just, you know, depending on your background, if you don't necessarily have a business background, it may not be obvious. But so every element of the way that I work with, interact with, and treat my clients is as professional as I ever would wearing a suit and tie, which, by the way, I still wear a suit and tie sometimes, but as I would when I was working, you know, in physics instrument sales. So if I say I'm going to do something, I do it. If I make an appointment, I'm on time. If I need to change something that I've said I'll do, I contact them ahead of time and change what I've, you know, what was promised. I make sure that wherever possible, I over exceed expectations. I keep communications on a very professional level, always polite, always respectful. If there's something that needs sorting out with a client, if there's a, you know, miscommunication, I'm always coming from it from a very respectful point of view, and you know, just what you would expect when you go into any service place or store, and you want to be treated well and respected. That's
so
how I
business,
treat my clients.
Business person, as an, you're an artist and also a business person, a professional. So the whole myth of, you know, I don't, an artist needing to be sort of slightly eccentric or wild or, you know, dramatic, you know, that's actually a myth from your experience.
It's, well, it's
professionalism that's
yeah, fun. I mean, it's not so much of a myth because, you know, I'm not one to overgeneralize. All I can say is that from a business point of view, if I want to develop my business and if I want repeat clients and if I want referrals, the only way that's going to happen is not only do I have to produce, you know, great art that speaks for itself, that people say, wow, I love that. That I also have to be someone who people like and who they can respect and who they enjoy working with. And so I really make that I mean, I can't help it because I love working with people, and you know me, you've met me, so you probably can already see from my personality, I'm just a people
person.
You're just
a light. I mean, the first thing I noticed about you is just how generous you were. I mean, we'd only been talking for a few minutes, and I told you what I was doing, and you were so keen to be involved and to help, and
I'm
appreciated that. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you. But I'm genuinely interested in what you're doing, but also my clients, what they're doing, and so for me, being a people person is an integral part of my whole relationship of how I earn my living as an artist. So anyway, that's just to say for, you know, the listeners and stuff, that being professional is, and having, you know, good contracts and well spelt out communication, proper expectations, you know, raised at the beginning and no surprises left in, etc. All
can
that
you
is,
give us some of the kind of just the basics of how you set things up? So say you are hoping to get a new client, for example, what would be the kind of whole process that you would go through to try and market yourself, to try and win a new client, and what happens there?
Well, a lot, you know, when I look at my clientele for my fine art, and I should, you know, explain that part of my business is education. And so I have a whole business in teaching, running, you know, workshops, and I have my online training website. So that's a whole other art-related business. But when it comes to my commissions, my fine art commissions, those have come through a series of some, you know, direct marketing efforts, such as participating in galas and charity events where I've had commissioned portraits as auction items. And then, you know, when something is bid on and purchased, then I follow up with the client. I invite them around to my studio. I do a lot of listening. I try to understand what their goal is, what they want. I show them a variety of, you know, what I've done and explain what the options are. And what I find is helpful is to have a well-written sort of contract that the that spells out the things you need spelt out at the beginning, things such as, first of all, what are we talking about in terms of the artwork, the size, the content, the expectations on delivery time, and then also things like copyright, things that you want to spell out at the beginning and not leave till later until there's a misunderstanding. So, for instance, when someone commissions an artwork, they may not realize that they are not owning the copyright to the image, and they can't just go and reproduce it, you know, put it on posters and things without permission or paying for that usage. The things like that, which you know, it's not a question of someone trying to take advantage of an artist or exploit them. It's a question of education. Also, on the other way around, such a document should have in it the fact that the artist reserves the right, you know, if they want to enter their design into a contest or to publish it in a magazine or use it for educational purposes, you know, if they feel that they want to. Because, I mean, otherwise people run into trouble where they've done a commissioned work and then they enter it into a contest or they use it in a lecture and then someone complains that, hey, that was my... You know, I commissioned you to do this painting. I didn't give you permission to do that. So all of that is much better discussed at the beginning. And I have had clients, I have certain celebrity clients who go through my contract and they cross this out and they cross that out and they say, under no circumstances should this be reproduced anywhere. And that's fine. I just say that's perfectly okay. As long as it's all upfront and clearly understood, then the process can flow, and also then there's trust between the artist and the client.
Well, it's up front. You know, you're talking through any misunderstandings right at the beginning before you get started on doing a commission.
Exactly.
Yeah. You create safety.
Yeah, and also I think the same issue comes up, of course, with money and pricing. And this is something which, you know,
Can I just say, Jeremy, you're so fantastic. I don't need to ask you any questions. You're telling me everything. I've got this list of questions here, but you're just in flow. It's great.
That's okay.
Carry on.
The issue with money and pricing has exactly the same elements come into play. And I think this is an issue that's difficult for a lot of artists, and including myself, because we're so emotionally attached to, you know, our art and our art process, and we don't want to muddy the waters with talking about price and costs and
so where does that
this
come into
cost
it?
That.
Yeah.
Well, where this comes in, I think, is the same element of make it easy for yourself and the client by having it all laid out up front, so there's no hidden costs that you have to come back to them later and say, by the way, yeah, I know I hadn't included the framing, or, you know, there's tax that I need to add in. Have it all mentioned in up front so that you can go through it with a client and say, so this is what, you know, you're paying for, and this is what's included, this is what isn't included, or this is what's an option. If you want to pay, you know, this much, we could add on this much. But have it so that it's up there in that initial contract, no surprises. You know, this includes framing or this doesn't include framing, this includes delivery, this doesn't, you know, and if there's sales tax in California, for instance, if I'm selling to a client in California, I have to add on sales tax, you know, things like that. You just want to have it so there's no surprises.
That's incredibly useful to hear. How do you actually price your pieces in the first place? I mean, when you're doing a commission and you haven't done the piece yet, how do you actually price it? Because, you know...
Well, that's a great question. And I think some of that... I mean, it's a combination of things that come into pricing, and there's no uniform answer for, you know, artists the world over. This is how to price your work. And I should add at this point that there are some really excellent publications. For instance, in America, there's the... what's it called? The... Graphic Artists Guild, you can just look them up on the web, and they have an annual booklet called Pricing and Ethics Guideline,
oh,
and
helpful.
It's really good. It goes through contracts, pricing, everything you can imagine, that, you know, in terms of giving you some samples, explaining what the range is typically. It's more aimed at commercial than fine art. But still, it's got some very useful stuff in it, so I recommend that. Mm-hmm. In terms of, you know, pricing for what I do, it's a little different. It's portraiture. You first of all should survey what's out there and what people are asking for different services. Mm-hmm. And you'll find, of course, that artists vary hugely in what they ask for instance, for portraiture, you know, from those who are doing things at a quite a low price to those, you know, doing oil paintings and asking tens of thousands of pounds for their oil paintings and everything in between. But you should survey what's out there and then also look at your own history as an artist, what things have sold for, what essentially is the market price for your work and talent and reputation. And then that then should help determine the level at which you should be pricing your work at this moment. And that's a dynamic thing that will change over time, especially as you grow as an artist, as your reputation grows, as the demand for your work hopefully grows.
Because I would imagine at the beginning people would tend to maybe underprice themselves because perhaps they don't have the confidence in their work. Is there a danger in that?
I don't know if I would ever say there's a danger because I think in the beginning you want to get your work out there, you want to be seen, you want to have your work in people's homes so that their friends see it. So actually I think it's really good to get your work out and to just be consistent with your pricing. So, you know, if it's under, you know, so-called underpriced, that might just mean that, you know, it's very good value. And if you get inundated with work and you can't keep up with it, then that is a good time to put your price up a bit.
Yeah.
You know, and if you're pricing something and you're not getting enough work, then I wouldn't go and put the price up at that point. But anyway, so all of that is just to give an example.
So going back to, you know, if people are starting out in becoming artists, what advice would you give to them about developing a range of artworks? Should people be developing a clear niche for themselves, do you think, early on in their career? Is that important?
Well, excellent questions. First of all, just to go back to my own story, because I can only really speak from you know, my own perspective of what has happened in my own life.
Mm-hmm.
So after I became, you know, made that decision to go for it, full-time artist, whatever that meant, whatever that vision was, and I'd got involved in going to these trade shows and demoing software as part of what I was doing, and I got to be a very early user of this program called Painter, which at the time was Fractal Design Painter, and after a couple of years, I got asked if I would teach at a local place in Palo Alto some people who wanted to learn Painter, and sure, you know. And then I got asked to teach at the Academy of Art College, now Academy of Art University in San Francisco, teach an introduction to computer painting. So I said, okay, why not? And then I got asked by someone to write a book, and you know, could you write a book about digital painting? And, oh, okay. You know, so all these things started unfolding. Now, it's not like I had the grand plan. I'm going to become an artist. I'm going to
I was going to say, did you have a five-year plan or anything?
But these things started unfolding naturally. And each one I just ran with, took it by the horns and found that I really enjoyed it. So I ended up, you know, writing a whole series of books over the last, you know, 10 or 15 years. And I've been running workshops, which I really love. And teaching's become part of my career, and I've really enjoyed it. So in terms of going back to your question, being open to the things that naturally unfold and then seeing them as potentially part of your business is actually an important part of, you know, the artistic development. So in other words, don't be, you know, absolutely attached to, I'm only going to do this and I'm going to ignore everything else.
Mm-hmm.
So having said that, there's always a value in focus. And, you know, my personality, I get interested in lots of things.
Mm-hmm.
But I have remained focused on the education and the fine art, although it's still a lot of different things I do. You asked about, like, specific style and, you know, should an artist create a niche or identify a niche and everything. I was talking to someone just recently who'd done graphic design at college and stuff, and they were sharing something their tutors told them, which I think is so brilliant, and that was that you can no, if I try to get the wording roughly right, but something to the effect of you can no more try to create a style than you can run away from your own style.
Uh-huh.
So what that means is that don't necessarily worry about, you know, artificially working on a style.
Mm-hmm.
You are your style. You will mm-hmm. exhibit and manifest your style mm-hmm. in everything you do, no matter what. Mm-hmm. Your personality will come out. Your mm-hmm. way of looking at the world will come out.
Mm-hmm.
Your perspective on things will come out. Your, you know, your use of color, your use of composition,
mm-hmm.
your what you like and don't like will all manifest itself in your artwork,
mm-hmm.
no matter what. With mm-hmm. you, and the irony is no matter what, whether you try to or you don't try to,
you can't help but you can't run away from it because it's there all the time.
Exactly. So in some respects, mm-hmm. I would say it's more important just to do things in the way you love to do things, mm-hmm. and allow
just following that passion, like you were saying before.
Exactly, and allow yourself to be respected for what you love to do. And actually, that is always I find the strongest things that people do. And what I've seen this in, you know, my workshops, that I have people come who sometimes they really want to emulate something else, and so they do something to try and emulate something else, and then we do an exercise where they just go for it and have fun and they play with color and they just do something for themselves,
mm-hmm.
and you know what, it always looks so much better. And in fact, one of my students came to one of my color workshops a few years ago. She's a professional photographer in Pennsylvania. And we did some exercises with really going for it and expanding your use of color in the way you paint. And she said what she did when she went back to her practice business was that when she was working with a client, she'd do a very conservative painting that really looked more photographic than painterly. But she thought, well, this is what they may like. It's conservative. It's mm-hmm. it's very photographic. And then she did one where she just went for it, had fun, used lots of color, and then she would show them both options. And she did this for a year with all her clients. And
right.
she wrote to me after a year and said, Jeremy, I just want to let you know how much I got out of your workshop and the fact that when I did this with all my clients for a year, they almost all chose the colorful one.
How interesting.
Isn't that funny? And I think
amazing.
That just says so much.
Yeah.
And she's a very successful photographer,
yeah.
and she runs a very successful business. And she integrates painting from her photos into everything she does, and she's
mm.
using painter all the time.
Mm. Well, that answers the question that I was kind of originally saying, which is how
mm.
customer-focused are you? And, you know, when you're doing a piece for a customer, how much are you compromising yourself? You know, or, you know, and it sounds to me like when you're doing what you love in the way you love it, you know, that's going to shine through rather than trying to do something for somebody else, because they're choosing you and your work because they like you already.
Exactly, and this is what it's exactly what I tell my students is like,
yeah.
you know, that people are going to love it when they are getting, you know, your work, whatever it is. They want to commission you because it's the Nicky Moran painting. They don't want Nicky Moran trying to be someone else. They want Nicky Moran being Nicky Moran,
yeah.
or Jeremy Sutton being Jeremy Sutton. So
yeah.
And I mean, this is what my client with this big painting for the building said. He said, I just want you to, you know, I just want to have an incredible piece of art. And he says, I just want you to go for it.
Yeah,
and
just
do something that's a talking point, that stands out. And so, and I think that that's something we can all think about in what we do for our clients. And that in the end, our clients will appreciate and will generate more clients.
Yeah. Like in the dancing world, Jeremy, I painfully know that as a dancer, I constantly have to craft myself. I constantly have to improve what I do and always work
right.
on my craft. Is
mm-hmm.
it the same with you as an artist? Do you always have to work on that?
Absolutely. I think there's so many parallels with dancing. You know, I've been doing Lindy Hop for 15 years now, and so sometimes I'll go out on the dance floor, and, you know, I always play with the music and my partner, but sometimes I find myself, I keep doing the same sort of steps and, you know, moves, and I'm in patterns. We're creatures of pattern, and, you know, that's how we survive in the world, but you know, I sometimes think, oh, I just got to get some, you know, new ways to move. And the same applies with my art. So, you know, I've been drawing almost, you know, most of my life. And in fact, drawing is really the core of all my painting. And I really have to, you know, stretch myself. One of the ways I've been stretching myself the last couple of years artistically has been very interesting. Another unexpected turn of events was that I got asked by the Fine Art Museums of San Francisco, which is the De Young and the Legion of Honor Museums, to perform as what's called a tableau vivant. That's sort of, it's almost like you recreate something and bring to life a tableau, a table. And I was asked to perform as Edgar Degas, and then as Vincent van Gogh, and then later this summer I'm going to be performing as Pablo Picasso. Now, I know, in each one of these cases, I do lots of research. I practice the paintings, I study the techniques, the approach, the compositional approach, the use of paint, etc., and the use of color. And I really work at trying to understand these artists, like, why is it they painted like they painted? And I start making paintings of my own that emulate their style. In order to be able to perform live painting in front of an audience in their style while I'm dressed up and everything.
Great.
And speaking French or Dutch. Well, I'm only kidding.
Yeah.
My French.
So it just adds a bit more richness again to your own style.
Yeah.
And it kind of expands your repertoire.
Absolutely. But what I found is that doing this has actually really helped me as an artist sort of really deepen my own mastery of the craft, so to speak. And I think it's really actually good for everybody, and I'm sure at the art school, you know, people do things where they'll follow the styles of different artists and learn from them in that way. But I think it's a really valuable exercise to do for everybody.
I suppose it's the ability to be able to kind of really understand the master's technique, but also having the confidence to express your own style.
Yeah, well, exactly. So the goal isn't that, oh, I'm going to now copy this artist and everything I'm doing is now going to be a copy in the style of, you know.
Yeah.
But more is to do with, let's just, you know, put myself in a different pair of shoes and stretch myself in trying to really understand the approach of different artists and see what I can learn from them, and then go back to just doing whatever I want for myself. But in the process, I'll have expanded my vocabulary.
That's great.
And
Jeremy,
so that's part of the way that I try to challenge myself.
Yeah, you sound so passionate about art, and I just love the way you are constantly challenging yourself, and the way you also really love helping other people as well. You must have worked with a lot of artists over the years and seen a lot of people also trying to be successful. What are the kind of mistakes that you see artists making?
Well, I mean, I work in a building with 40 artists, and so it's been, and I've been there for 6 or 7 years in that building. So, you know, I've seen, you know, obviously a lot of artists, and over the years I met a lot of artists. Let me just think how to answer that question. Well, it's a difficult one. What I would say is there's certain principles that are important. And so I think professionalism is funny. We come back to the same echo of the same points.
I wondered if that was going to be.
Professionalism, I would say, is really important. You know, taking, and it's a matter of not only respect your clients, it's a matter of taking yourself seriously. So if you, you know, you will only be taken as seriously by other people as you take yourself. And so your professionalism says to people, I'm serious about this. mm-hmm. you know, the way that, you know, you attack a problem. And the thing I love about commissioned portraiture and paintings is that I see it as problem solving, a bit like my old physics career. So I love problem solving, and so that is a classic case of problem solving. And so I'm always open to interesting problems and to understanding what's at the core and the essence of what the goal is. Mm-hmm. And that's something that's really important. Now, in terms of other artists and
other artists don't tend to do that so much.
Well, I think certainly sometimes people are not necessarily so finicky about being professional in their approach. You know, some are, some aren't. And you can tell those who are right away.
Can I ask something about it? Because I know this has come up in a few of my sessions with clients.
Sure.
Because one thing we often talk about is authenticity and really expressing who you are and being who you are and bringing that out in your artwork.
Absolutely.
And then one of my clients, you know, one of the things she struggled with was when she goes into, for example, having a business meeting, she doesn't know how to conduct herself because she feels awkward. And we had this play on, you know, well, who are you? What doesn't get expressed when you go into those meetings? And she was saying, well, there's an eccentricity about me and my personality. I'm kind of a quirky person, and I feel like I've got to limit myself when I go into a very businessy situation, which appears very monochrome to me, and I feel a little uncomfortable.
You know, it's so interesting. I just share a little experience. Just a couple of weeks ago, I met with my client from Oakland, and he was coming over to the studio to look at some of my designs for this project. And I've met him obviously over the years, so he knows me very well. I know him pretty well. It was a really hot day in San Francisco, but I decided I just wanted to look nice. I like to dress up. You know, you see me in the Lindy scene. I like to wear a suit and stuff.
You're very dapper.
So I just felt like dressing up. So I dressed up, you know, nice suit and tie. And it was really hot weather. So he turns up in the cowboy hat with jeans and a sort of T-shirt, very relaxed. And he jokes with me. He says, "Hey," he says, "you didn't need to dress up." And I said, "Well, I just wanted to, you know." And so we had our meeting and everything. Now, the point being here that, you know, I just felt like dressing up, even though, in fact, my client was very casual, as, you know, and comfortable in the way he dressed. But you know, I think that there's you can totally be yourself as a personality and a character and an artist, and that includes, you know, dressing in the way that you feel comfortable dressing in. And that there's no contradiction between that and being really professional in a business meeting with your client. And in fact, I think clients welcome the fact you're being genuine, authentic, and yourself, and part of the art. You are part of your art. There's no doubt about that. So,
well, what struck me is if you come in dressed exactly like your client, then they would be confused because there would be an expectation for you to be arty.
Yeah. So what I would say is that with this client who you were just talking about, who said, "Well, I'm a bit quirky, but I feel a bit limited in a business meeting," I'd say totally be yourself, but just remember professionalism. So if quirkiness means that you swear or you use language which is a bit too colorful, that I think is inappropriate. Professionalism means appropriate, but doesn't mean cut out the character and personality. So I think
it's just understanding that sort of subtlety, because you've worked in a business setting for years, and I've worked in a corporate sector for years as well. So I think it took me quite a while to understand how to bridge that gap, how to still be mean and to also be professional. And I think there's something about understanding the code, and it's respecting that, you know, you're dealing with people, they're not.
Right, and you got to remember that whatever you say in any context with when you're with a client or with anybody, I mean, this applies to vendors, it applies to anybody, whatever you say in that context, if you say anything about anybody in that context, who you're with will think, if you say that about someone else, you could say that about them. Mm. So you never criticize anybody else. Mm-hmm. You're always respectful to everybody you're talking about or with or to. And so that is the, you know, essence of being professional. So you don't say things, oh, and complain about this other client or complain about this or complain about that. You don't do any of that. You're always positive.
Yeah.
You're always respectful. Doesn't mean you can't be really quirky and fun and funny and odd, you know, and even eccentric.
Yeah.
But you don't. But you do it in a way that's not picking on any person or group. And, you know, all those things that you don't tell a joke that's at anybody's expense.
I think that's brilliant.
You don't tell jokes that generalize about any group of people, gender of people, or in any way can be taken as offensive.
Mm.
It's common sense. But, you know,
it's not common sense to everybody, particularly if you've not worked in business. If you've just been to art school and, you know, you've just been an artist, then that actually isn't common sense. I think there's something about working in business that's really valuable for learning those innate business skills.
And the other thing I would say, I mean, just while we're on this topic of what is the behavior, you know, when you're an artist with a client, you know, there's certain things you are very careful about and you avoid. So, for instance, and it may be different in England to America, but I am very careful not to talk about religion, politics, you know, all those sort of things which are hot-button topics, but particularly religion and politics. You know, if a client brings something up, you know, you have to, you know, you respond appropriately, but you don't want to get involved in that sort of thing. This is my opinion. In a professional communication that's to do with art, you don't want to get involved in talking about the government or the president or policies. Or now, you know, and obviously as you get to know a client better and better, there may be more discussion of current affairs and things, and you know, you may make a comment here or there, but I'm very, very careful about that. And it's something I think that, you know, again, that's just professionalism. You don't you avoid topics which someone can get really upset about, or, you know, that are controversial, or that are very emotional and nothing to do with your art. So you have to be really, really careful.
And I think the other big thing for me that you've talked about is you're actually very customer focused. And when you go into a meeting, you're very much focused on what they want and what their goals are. And you listen, which I think is key. And I think a lot of artists, you know, that because going through art school, you're focusing on you. And you're focusing on your expression. So actually, it's having that sense to put your attention over there.
Exactly. And that's another thing that, of course, the lady who asked you that question, I think it was a lady, right, about the wanting to be quirky and everything, but feeling a bit awkward about the business meeting aspect of it. So I think if she just focuses on the fact that she's there to learn from her client and to understand them, then it takes off all the pressure of like, oh, how should I behave, and what are they going to think of me, and because it's nothing to do with any of that. It's to do with, I really want to understand what's at the core of what they're looking for, and how, you know, let me try and understand them as fully as I can, especially this is my golden opportunity when I'm meeting in person with them. And and being clear if you know, it's a stage where she has to communicate something about what she can offer, just being clear about what it is, you know, she can do and can't do, and, you know, anything like that.
Yeah, that's brilliant advice. I'm going to capture that and put it in a blog right now. I think that's absolutely key. I think that's brilliant.
Oh, good. Well,
incredible.
Glad.
Yeah. I'm just also curious about the kind of marketing efforts. You talked originally about how you do things like trade fairs. What other marketing efforts did you do back then, and do you continue to do that really work in getting new clients and raising your profile? What other things
would
you recommend?
Right. Well. Again, I feel like, honestly, I feel, first of all, like I'm not much of an expert to answer that question. I mean, I do what I do, and some things work and some things don't. What has worked with me for a certain segment of my clientele is working with those charity galas, putting in really decent commissions as donated items.
So
then as a result, making some good clients who have become repeat clients, and so you've got to find the right connection though, because there's a lot of things out there that you'll just end up doing a lot of free work, and there's no way to make a business work. You'll end up not necessarily getting profitable business. So you have to be selective in the way that you do that.
When you go for things like charity galas, are you approaching them? Are they approaching you? How does that work?
Let's see. They approach me.
Okay.
I guess somehow there's a connection and someone contacts me and they've met. That might be different in England to America. I mean, there's a lot more charity galas, I guess.
I don't know about charity galas over here.
But and then
how about galleries and things? Did you ever sort of try and approach galleries when you were starting out?
Well, it's so funny. I mean, there's a whole gallery world. I haven't really I haven't really put a lot of time and effort into it. Now, that's not to say that you can't develop your career very successfully through gallery representation. Mm. That's probably for an interview with another artist who is an example of a successful, gallery artist. And I'm not that artist because I really do things on the outside of the gallery system, you could say.
Mm. Who are your main clients then, Jeremy?
Well, it's funnily enough, my main grouping of clients for my commissioned artwork, and obviously, like I say, I have a whole educational side of my business, and I produce DVDs and books, so that's a whole different clientele.
Mm.
But for my fine art, there seems to be quite a number of them who are developers on the East Bay. I mean, it's so specific. You're asking me this question. Here we go. But that's how it is. They seem to be a particular group of people who are in similar businesses that connected with developing buildings. And they're mostly living in a particular area of the Bay Area, and that being the East Bay.
Mm.
So, and I don't know why that's turned out that way, but it has. So I think
that's interesting.
When
you
find
you do have a niche, even
well,
though
inadvertently, it's turned out that way. So.
Mm.
But
one of the things I was one of my artists. Clients was saying, how do I find customers and how do I know which are my customers? Because a classic business technique is to research your audience or think about who your ideal audience would be.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering if that works in the art world or is it just something that kind of naturally happens through the work you produce and a certain type of audience will buy it and some won't. And there's your answer. Did you set out to
No. I mean, it's not at all. And that's something that, I just looking back, it's like, isn't that funny? It's like, there's just a lot of, it turns out there's a lot in that one, they're in the same profession related area in the same location. So having said that, with my educational work, I have a wide variety of people come to my workshops, but there's been certain demographics. I get a certain number of retirees who are really going for it in, later in life to go for their artistic potential and loving it. And then I get certain professionals, often doctors, and, I've had lawyers, I've had policemen and people, but for some reason, doctors in particular, who have photography as a major hobby. And, I mean, they take their photography as seriously as any professional, and they often have, they usually have professional-level equipment that's at least as good as a professional. And, so they have been also part of my clientele in my educational work, which I wouldn't necessarily have predicted. It's like, that's interesting.
Oh, how interesting. And do they buy your work as well, the people that your workshop?
Do you know what? Not so much. It's really like two hermetically sealed world.
Interesting.
Different worlds. There's a little bit of crossover here and there, but very little. So mostly they're different.
Mm. And have you ever used any kind of press agencies or done much press or PR over the years to raise your profile?
Well, this is a good question. I've done, I work with PR a lot on the educational side of things because I'm very close with the vendors. So I work with Corel, who make the painting software Painter, and I work with Wacom, who make the tablets. And so they, you know, I'm in their sort of e-newsletters now and then, and they, you know, they publicize things. So I work with them on the PR, but that's all for the educational things. And then on the fine art side, you could say that my projects like The Heart in San Francisco, which was, you know, a great honor to be selected as one of the 8 artists to be commissioned to do that for this year. That's a fantastic project on every level. It's great kudos. It's and for anyone listening, if you go to jeremysutton.com and click on The Heart on the front page and then scroll down, you'll see a webcam which is looking at The Heart 24/7.
Oh,
and
great.
You can actually see all the people go up and have their photos taken in front of it. It's quite cute.
Oh,
actually.
How fun.
Yeah. The webcam is intermittent, so right as of the moment, it's working fine.
Mm-hmm.
So if you go and have a look, you might be able to see The Heart in real time in the middle of San Francisco. But going back to what you were saying, so the PR from doing a project like that is immense. And that definitely helps. You know, overall, it helps with the respect that you get as an artist when, you know, when you're talking to clients about yourself or when they hear about you. The same with working with the prestigious museums, the Legion of Honor and the De Young and things like that. It's very, very, you know, very prestigious and a great honor, and something that, you know, helps in terms of the public relations.
That's incredible.
It doesn't.
Do you mind me asking, you know, how you got these amazing commissions?
Sure. And I should just add, it doesn't necessarily automatically mean you get commissioned business from it. Hold on. Hi, Nikki.
Hello.
So sorry about that. There's a little. Slight tea interruption here. I'm being presented with a beautiful cup of tea in the garden.
Oh, how nice. Can I have one, please? One sugar.
So, just start again. What was your question just
now? Yeah, my question was how you got those sorts of commissions, those very prestigious ones. Did you have to apply for them? How did that work?
Yep, the Heart is a open call for artists to send in submissions, and so I just came up with a design and you know, sent it in as a submission into an art contest essentially, and then they selected the ones they liked. And so it's worth keeping an eye out for things like that, especially I think, you know, things that are local to where, you know, you live as an artist. You don't necessarily have to go for all international this and international that. Sometimes it's good to work with local things and develop yourself locally. And then the museum job was through the director of the program, public programs there, knowing my art. She'd seen my art, and so she had me in mind, and she approached me about it. So I had no idea or didn't even think of it.
Must have been delighted.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
How amazing. What a wonderful opportunity. And it is beautiful because I was actually in San Francisco and I saw it. And I was staying in Union Square, so I passed it. Yeah, it's absolutely stunning.
Oh, well, thank you. You actually saw it.
I did see it. Yeah, yeah. I mean, we had that conversation when we were dancing and you said, and you showed me the postcard. And I went, oh, my God, I was there and I saw that. Amazing. What
That's
an achievement.
Right.
Phenomenal.
Yeah. Thank you for that.
Yeah,
I suddenly looked at the clock. I realized I actually have to go pretty soon.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, so thank you so much for your time. I'm going to ask you just one last question.
Oh, and I had a couple of things to add, which I didn't want to miss out from saying as well. So should I add them and then you ask me the last question?
Yeah, absolutely. Go for it.
Okay, so the two things that I wanted to just add and make sure we included here that I think are important for what you're doing with your clients. One is there is no perfect time to decide to be an artist. There is no perfect time. The circumstances are not all perfectly, you know, aligned at one moment in time that says, ah, without any doubt, I should go for it. So in other words, whenever you decide to do it, you just do it. And it will never be the perfect time. Mm-hmm. So, but, you know, you just have to decide on the commitment to the process and the ups and downs. Okay. And then the other thing is think big. And so as you're doing things, always think big.
That's funny. Well, my last question was going to be, what would be the main advice that you would give to either a struggling artist or an up-and-coming artist?
The two things I just said about the perfect time and, you know, don't forget to think big. And I think, finally, just be true to yourself and have fun.
Yeah. Oh, Jeremy, thank you so much for your incredible generosity and giving me your time today. You've given so much really incredibly useful information. I'm so grateful. So I'll make sure that when I send this out, I'll put a link to your event, and hopefully we'll get some interest for the night on the 25th of July in London.
Mm-hmm.
And best of luck. I hope it goes really, really well.
Well, thank you. Will you be able to make it? Will I get to see you?
I will absolutely try and get down there.
Okay.
Bring in a couple of people as well. I hope to see you out dancing soon as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, take care, Nikki, and
thank
lovely
you so
time.
Much.
It's been very
really
stimulating.
Really appreciate it. Take care, Jeremy.
All the best. Bye.